to Sinner, Season 2, Episode 4, and Episode 3. They're both over, but we're just getting started here on Post-Show Recaps. Hello, everybody. I'm Josh Wigler. I'm joined here by the beacon in my life, at least, Antonio Mazzaro. Antonio, how are those eggs in your brain doing?
I was going to ask you the same question, Josh.
They're not well. They're red. They're fried. They're scrambled. They're all sorts. They're cooked in every single way that you can cook an egg.
They're supposed to be over easy, or maybe at best over medium. I'm doing okay, Josh. Yeah, we didn't do episode three. I heard you were out. You were on a rumspringa of some sort. You were in the woods wandering around.
Rumham. It was rumham. You got it wrong. I was enjoying a rumham.
Summer rumham.
Summer of Rumham. No, I was away. Tried to record this with Antonio before I left. Completely my bad. I misjudged my schedule and was not able to do it. I apologize for that. But we have not given up on The Sinner. We are very much still in on The Sinner, even though The Sinner is getting really weird. And I am starting to feel like maybe I'm a little too stupid to follow the show, but I'm doing my best. It is very, very interesting and entertaining and super weird. Super weird show that we're talking about here, Antonio.
Just let the old hag sit on your chest, Josh.
What is up with the old hag? I'd never heard about the old hag before.
I haven't either. Yeah, this is some, like, Joseph thing? Campbell stuff. I don't know. Like, old hag? Is it a crone? I don't really know what's happening.
Yeah, wait,
there.
What is the old hag? So the old hag is like this figure of myth that appears in your dreams and, like, puts its hand through your stomach. Is the old hag the thing that visits Dan Aykroyd in Ghostbusters?
Wait a minute. Which one are we talking about with Dan Aykroyd and Ghostbusters?
There's the scene where, like, he's like, it's like the Ghostbusters theme song montage, and then
that's the one I'm thinking of. Yep,
that's what I'm thinking of. Yeah,
no, I think the old hag is like Kerry Coombs describing it, the sitting on the chest part. I think it's the sleep paralysis. Something is happening to explain why you might wake up and feel awake but not be able to move. There's an old hag sitting on your chest.
Oh, well, then the old hag visits me regularly. I'm well acquainted with the old hag. I just had no idea that that's who was doing this to me.
You need to get like some kind of hag, anti-hag device in your house.
Haggis, maybe.
Like a hag light.
The old hag hates haggis. They don't eat their own kind.
They... That's not true at all, I don't think. I don't think you need to bone up on your old hag.
Can an old hag visit an old hag and terrorize an old hag in their dreams?
Can one old hag sit on another old hag's chest? This is like Turtles All the Way Down.
Or is it like antimatter and then like the universe combusts?
This is like how many angels can fit on the head of a pin kind of thing. Yeah, I don't know. This is the old hag in this story, I don't believe is an actual old hag. Like, this is clearly something that they've tried to explain away to Julian, and I think we'll get into theories about what the hooded figure might be in this particular case. Julian keeps saying he's sure it's not a dream, and that he doesn't know when he's dreaming or awake. I think somebody was actually in that hood, and we'll talk about the possible suspects for that, Josh. The story is certainly heating up. Lots of things have happened in The Sinner.
Up is triggering. I hope Bill Pullman is not listening.
Oh, no. There's a fire. Yeah. So
sale.
Bad.
Yeah.
So bad. Oh, my gosh. Yeah, there's a fire sale. There's a burning. It's bad. It's so bad. Bill Pullman's in a bad place, Josh. I think you texted me after the fourth episode saying the way that episode ended was so creepy.
Yeah, it was a messed up ending. It really was. A lot has happened over these two episodes. Clearly, we missed talking about episode three. We are now timing this to episode four. I think as a result, at least I could speak for myself, my thoughts are a little jumbled because I watched them both very closely together. So I think we'll dig into as much as we can over the course of this podcast and hopefully try to make some sense of what's going on. But I remember when I couldn't watch this episode last week, when I couldn't watch the show last week, and was going to be late to watching episode three, you had texted me after the fact and you said, oh, it's really good. Great Mr. Robot connection in episode three of The Sinner. And I thought, you know, people who listen to you and I podcast very likely or hopefully they've listened to you and I talk about Mr. Robot. So I was so curious going into episode three to figure out what the Mr. Robot connection was going to be. And even after watching it, I didn't know what you were talking about. And then you put the eggs in my brain of what it was that had transpired. Please do the same for the listeners here.
Let's maybe drop that metaphor if we can.
No, I think we're gonna keep that. I think that's coming with us along with upstate New York, all of that.
So the first the episode three, the investigation that Ambrose and Novak undertake is essentially trying to trace the through line of Julian and Julian's parentage. Novak finds this box in her friend Marin's childhood bedroom that has a book that has the word Julian underlined a lot, and that leads her to believe that her friend Marin might actually be Julian's mother. She says at that point, every time I look at Julian, I thought something looked familiar about him, about his face. So she's thinking that Marin might be Julian's mother. That causes Novak and Ambrose to look at the birth certificate. They go to visit the doctor who signed the birth certificate. And it's this genial old man. He was the OBGYN who delivered Novak himself. He's so friendly. He's so nice. But Josh, they start asking him questions about what he did at Mosswood and how many times did he go out there and what other things was he involved in out at Mosswood. And that causes him to say, let me check my files. And he goes upstairs and he slices his own throat. And
Files done. Like the doctor.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, you've got mail. The unfortunate thing is this actor, Richard Beckins, he was the actor on Mr. Robot who took his own life, spoiler alert, on camera at the end of season one. So this is just a guy, Richard Beckins, who takes his own life on USA shows.
On the USA, yeah. On the USA Network. He is the person you call. Yeah, that's crazy.
He's the anti-Blue Skies. That's Dr. Poole.
Dark Skies
Network. This is Dick Beckins. Rough time for Dick Beckins.
Rough time indeed. That was a really wild development in last week's episode when this seemingly just totally mild-mannered, perfectly nice doctor has killed himself in such gruesome fashion, and really makes you wonder what kind of stranglehold the Mosswood situation has over this town, where people you would not suspect of being like deeply indoctrinated clearly are. Like, this guy had the rock set up and everything like that. Clearly he was a disciple.
Yeah, indoctrinated. Yeah, he's really in. He had the symbol and he had the little rock. He had his little secret place. He had his journals. From his journals, they find the picture of the person that's to be known as the Beacon, the person who in episode 4 we start finding more about, that may his teachings or his theories may be at the heart of some of the things that went on at Mosswood. So that is the doctor is a major link for them. The other thing that the doctor does for them is that the doctor gives them a link via the malpractice claim that had been filed against him. And I think, Josh, this may speak to why he took his own life as well. The malpractice claim that was filed against him leads the investigation to that asylum. And at the asylum, Arkham Asylum, in upstate New York, they famously overlooking the Hudson, they ultimately discover the claimant, the person who made the malpractice claim against Dr. Poole, says that she went in for a procedure to terminate a pregnancy, and he ended up taking the ute, which is very unfortunate. She said that was not something that she permitted him to do. It makes me wonder, Josh, did he perhaps take his own life because he knew he was caught? And did he think he was caught in some larger thing? How many times did he do that is my question.
Yeah, like is he protecting some kind of greater secret about how people at Mosswood are, like, are they trying to, like, reproduce to find a messiah or something like that? That's what I'm wondering, is if there's some sort of shady shenanigans going on in that regard. But it certainly makes sense. I mean, if he'd been caught on something as savage as removing a patient's uterus without their consent, that guy's going to prison probably forever, right? I am no lawyer, but I am speaking with one.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, for a guy his age, probably forever, right? The downside to that is it may not have just been one. I'm of the inclination believing that, yeah, there's some kind of...
He'd done this to a few.
If Julian's the only kid that's living there and he's special, like, I think part of the story that we're going to that's going to unfold will be, yeah, this was probably happening in more than one instance. And something with the Beacon, as the unfortunate patient, Carmen Bell, I believe her name is, the person who is claiming the malpractice, and she's really screwed up, unfortunately, because of her time at Mosswood or otherwise. She basically says that the Beacon, you know, he liked to have pretty things around, but he grew quickly bored of them. So I'm not sure what this means. Did Marin become the Beacon's right-hand man, or right-hand woman in this case? Is Marin, in fact, Julian's mother? What do you think about that? Do you believe that the investigation is correct in this regard and that Marin is indeed Julian's mother?
Yeah, I think it gives a personal connection to Heather Novak. I think that for her to be that interwoven to the story and to have that kind of skin in the game, that it's her ex-girlfriend, it's the one who disappeared, she's not heard hide nor hair from this person since she disappeared and went off to Mosswood. I think for her to be Julian's birth mother would make a lot of sense. And I think also it makes a lot of thematic sense that that Vera, who seems to be kind of like the mother of Mosswood, would be the mother to Julian in that non-literal sense. So I'm buying it. I think that it'd be very strange to have gotten this far down the path, especially if Heather's hunch that Julian looks like Marin, for that not to bear out. I feel like we're on the right track on that one. Do you disagree?
No, it also times out, right? They say Julian was born about 9 months after she entered Mosswood, and it would make sense. Here's a question I have. If following that through line where you talk about Vera being his surrogate mother, if you will, the surrogacy was established immediately. I mean, that was something where it was just a few days after Julian was born that Dr. Poole came there and established Vera as the mother. So it, whether or not she is or is not the mother, it does make you feel like maybe something more is afoot here. And what I would say is it possible? I think this could springboard us into a larger conversation about Vera. Where do you stand on Vera as far as good versus evil? Is she the ultimate mastermind? Or do you think she's actually maybe just a pawn or somebody who has a more positive role in things, and that the larger evil players may in fact be Marin and the Beacon together? Or if you wanted to speculate about where we're headed in this regard, and this maybe is where you're getting into the you don't feel smart enough for the show. But I want to know. That's where my mind's at. My mind is at, okay, I think Marin is probably still alive in some respect.
Okay. I was wondering if she is or isn't, and I am not convinced. Like, I feel like much in the same way that Heather has to have this kind of connection to the story and this rooting interest, I think for her to be so gravely disappointed when she finds out that Marin is not alive, that to me feels like the direction that this is going in. If Marin is alive, where is she? Is she just being like held on like the tightest, strictest lockdown? You know, is she somebody that Vera knows and cares about if she's alive? To your question about do I trust Vera or not, or like where do I believe that she is going to reside in terms of the whether she's with or against the Anaconda snakes, I feel like she's on their side. I do not trust Vera at all. I think that Vera is bad news, especially with how this episode ended for our man Bill Pullmantonio. I think that Detective Ambrose waking up in the motel with no idea of how he got there, somebody would have had to handle his gun and his badge and all of that for him to get there. That seems spectacularly shady to me.
Yeah, but maybe also fun. I don't know. It seemed pretty cool for a little while there.
Do we think that they made the bond? Do we think that do we think that Ambrose and Vera did it go?
I think he's been making the eight. He's just going all over the state at this point.
Figure eight.
I don't know. That's a good question. If that happened, it could be by means of getting sort of leverage over Bill Pullman and the investigation as a whole. That may have been something was in that green tea, perhaps, that he drank, and it didn't kill him, but it maybe it roofied him or put him on the ground in a way that he could be taken advantage of and wakes up in a motel that he doesn't know where he is, etc. So I think that could be by means of getting leverage over him. I still don't necessarily feel like that. Like 100% makes Vera evil in the grand scheme. I think she may be self-protecting, and I think she may be protecting of the people that are at Mosswood, but it's possible in my mind that Marin is actually in a position where she is perhaps the greater evil. When you said Heather's disappointment is going to be key for you, I think Heather's disappointment could come from the fact that Marin is alive and bad. I point to the video that Heather finds where Heather goes to the storage unit. So she follows the through line, right? What she does is she starts continuing to think about, and I don't know why she has suppressed this. We may find out more in terms of flashback. We may not. She has never investigated what happened to Marin. And she basically says that she didn't do it because Marin didn't want her to when she's asked about it. And so she's now doing that. And she's now unraveling all of these threads that maybe she never confronted in the past. And one of the things that she does is she talks to your boy, Josh, Tracy Letts. She talks to Jack Novak and says, remember that time you picked me up hammered drunk and we went and found my friend staggering down the middle of the road and you talked to her and I don't remember what you said. What did you say? And Tracy Letts says she had a tattoo. She had this tattoo on her arm. This is what she drew for me. It's a labyrinth. So this is all very complicated. Heather looks up the symbol, finds the book, finds the name of the beacon, tracks the book down to a bookseller who says, oh, yeah, this is what I know about the guy. And by the way, I tried to sell it to this address and it came back unreturnable. Heather goes to the address, finds the storage unit. It's in Julian's name. There are a bunch of the author's books there. Julian's or somebody, a child's clothes are there. Somebody's perhaps been living there. And there as well is a tape. And when Heather watches the tape, it's an old session from 2005. And in that session, Marin is watching this horrible stuff go down, like beating and violence. And I don't know, man, Marin does not look, she doesn't look concerned about it at all to me in that tape. So,
well, she looks like she's in. She looks like she's in. Whether or not she has like the you know, the like top level agency within the organization, that's something that I would question. But I think like she's definitely, she's hooked into what's going on.
Yeah.
She seems like she is there for it.
So the question is, if Julian was her kid and he was the quote unquote chosen one and he was being raised there, and that would probably give her some position of prominence in the organization. And I don't know why that was covered up, the fact that it would have been her kid. It's very suspicious, but I think it's possible that Marin is the hooded figure, the old hag that is visiting Julian.
Oh, interesting. Like this is so that less that it's like just sort of like this nightmare figure that he's manifesting, and more that it's based on a memory, that it's like a nightmare that's based on a person specifically.
Yes. And I think maybe it's possible, and this is taking the other side of the coin, but if you view Vera as on the side of the anaconda snakes, then, and something bad happened with Marin, maybe what was happening with Bess and Adam was that they were actually trying to emancipate Julian and free him from the clutches of these people and get him to the point where he could reunite with Marin. Maybe that was part of the plan. Maybe she's in hiding because she escaped. Maybe Adam, who had only been at Mosswood for a few months, was someone that was sent in perhaps by Marin to help emancipate Julian and get him out of there. That may have been part of it. So I think there are two sides to that coin as well. And if that's the side, then maybe what Vera is trying to do is get Julian to have a very negative association with the old hag and view that as something negative in his life, something to be afraid of, when in reality it was Marin trying to free him. I think all of these things are on the table. And I think that's really what I'm tracking going forward, is whose side is Marin on? Whose side is Vera on? Is Marin, in fact, still alive? Is the beacon still alive? Like, what's going on with this guy? There was a very visceral reaction from Carmen Bell there in the asylum. She really, in the psych institute, she really had a reaction to the beacon. She was like resting and just pulling her shirt off and beating her head. Like, she really wanted that picture. And it was a tiny little picture. So this guy clearly has some power over people.
Yes, the psychotherapist Lionel Jeffries is the real name of the beacon, as we find out in this episode. And he looks like, maybe you'll know what this is. You know that there's like this, speaking of nightmare figures, there's like people around the world who like swear that they have seen like this same guy who pops up in their dreams. Have you ever heard about this, Antonio?
Vaguely, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm forgetting the name of the phenomenon. Somebody can let us know in the comments or tweet at Antonio and I at AC Mazzaro at Round Howard. But this guy just like had like sort of like that ubiquitous look of just like, you've seen him before. There's just something harrowing about this guy. It makes me wonder if we are going to see Lionel Jeffries in the series proper. Is it supposed to be somebody that we already know? Like the most conspiratorial that I have gotten watching the show so far far was wondering, is there any possibility that this guy and Tracy Letts are the same person? You and I were joking about, well, the Beacon puts eggs in your brain. Tracy Letts cooks eggs for Bill Pullman all the time.
Yeah, he's always talking about breakfast and making eggs. So, yeah.
Eggs and Beacon, they go together.
And he's, so there is another connection. And I'm not saying that Tracy Letts is the Beacon, but
I don't think so.
When we mentioned the tape earlier, the tape that Heather is watching, where Marin is turning her head to the side, we mentioned that we didn't mention ultimately what I think is the real takeaway from that tape, which is the person on the tape was somebody that you recognize, Josh.
Yes. So the actor Mark Menchaca, which is a very fun
name. Oh, that's my favorite drink.
Say. Yes, you.
I love a nice Menchaca.
He's a great actor that I know Antonio is a fan of, who plays the character Russ Langmore on Ozark, who appeared last week, and I'm blanking on the name of the character.
Upstate Sudeikis is what I call him.
You call him Upstate Sudeikis. He's the guy who was throwing the party that that Jack brought Detective Ambrose to be like, if you're going to stick around, you have to socialize a little bit. And he brings him to this party. And this is the guy who's talking about, like, you should just go all Waco on those people at Mossgrove. He has some larger important role in the community as well, too, right? Like, this is a kind of powerful figure.
Yeah, I think when Jack is dragging Bill Pullman, like, by his feet into that party that he has no interest in attending, like, negative interest in attending, yeah, I think that Jack reflects that this is some really rich dairy family, that they own a lot of dairies in the state, and that they're really well connected. And you get the impression that all the important people are here, and it's the rich and powerful. It seems like one of those backroom meetings. Later on, Bill Pullman meets his old flame in the backyard, so it's not a men-only meeting, but it just feels like one of those kind of places. And the chief of police is there, and Bill Pullman's getting immediate shit about the fire that occurred at his house when he was a kid. And yeah, the Upstate Sudeikis, Glenn Fisher, played by Mark Menchaca, he says, like, the best way to treat those people is to go Waco on them. And he's talking about, you're really like setting them on fire and killing them all, which is awkward when we talk about the Bill Pullman fire, but it's also a really awkward thing to just say in a conversation. But this is allegedly a really powerful and influential guy. And Josh, we're pretty convinced this is the same guy that's on the tape that Rachel views, that is got blood all over his shirt, and then he goes and beats someone up off camera.
Yeah, he just goes and beats somebody up off camera, and like, this is somebody who is so anti Mosswood, and yet here he is being therapized by Mosswood. Like, yeah, he's doing the work, and he's like doing a workover on somebody off camera. He's working somebody over, and it's very curious to juxtapose that man and that perspective with the person we are seeing in this episode. You know, somebody who was so wildly against this community, who is participating in the community, though he himself is bloodied up in the tape as well. So immediately, new person of interest on the board, and beyond that, between this guy and Dr. Poole, there are people who you just would not be expecting to be hooked in to Mosswood that are hooked into Mosswood, like normal everyday people. And so to revisit like the conspiratorial thing, not that I really believe that Heather's father is going to turn out to be the Beacon or anything like that. But I don't know about you, but there is just something that seems a little bit off about him sometimes. And one of the scenes that felt really off to me was in this episode when Heather is having the flashback to the night Marin ran away, and her father is like driving her around, and he gets out of the car and he goes and has a conversation with Marin. And from Heather's perspective, she does not hear the contents of the conversation. You eventually get from Jack's perspective, it's like, how am I supposed to remember any of that? That, you know, that was a crazy night. That was 10 years ago. Who knows? And then he opens up and tells his daughter what he remembers. But you get that from his perspective. Like, you don't get that from Heather's perspective. And so I'm just wondering, is he hooked in like a tiny bit more? Is he really just the nice, friendly guy who's looking out for everybody and making them eggs? Or is there just something that's like a little tiny bit off about him where he knows more than he's letting on?
It's a good observation. sort of loosely pressing Bill Pullman throughout, like, hey, you're about wrapping up, right? Like, the investigation's almost over, right? Like, you're not gonna do anymore, right? And he doesn't, and I think on some level he was probably protecting Heather at first when he says an old high school friend of Heather's went in there and we never saw her again. He's not being completely honest about the whole thing with Bill Pullman, and I think that some of that is to protect Heather, no doubt. When Heather sees him weeding in the backyard and says, hey, I think that Julian might actually be Marin's son, he says, I don't remember what she said to me that night, but then he does draw the symbol, and it's an interesting right. thing. He draws the symbol with the labyrinth. The symbol that is on her arm doesn't have the labyrinth on it. It's just the Y with the dot. So how does he know?
It's like he remembers exactly how she told it to him. So like he goes from 6 to midnight on that pretty quick of like, I don't remember anything about that night. Oh, I remember the tattoo and exactly what it meant and how it worked.
Yeah, and the how it worked part is odd, because the tattoo, if you look at it, I don't think it has all those circular lines. I think it's just the Y with the dots, and he draws the Correct. Circular lines. So he maybe does know more than he's letting on.
Circular lines. Yeah.
I hate them. I don't know ultimately where that is going, but there are those moments. I think it was weird that he dragged Bill Pullman to that party. Bill Pullman did not want to go. I don't know why Bill Pullman needed to go. It did not strike me as something that needed to happen. And there are continual repeated scenes between Tracy Letts and Bill Pullman where there are just these moments, and they could be read as friendship moments. After the party, Bill Pullman, he just gets triggered by his ex saying, you fled when you were 17. It was a lot for you to have to deal with, none of your parents and all that. And he just disappears. And then he wakes up like banging his head into a tree. And Tracy Letts is, hey, you really, you got to tell me some stuff. Like, you never said anything to me over the years. I keep saying, are you okay? Because you don't seem okay. And like I said, all this stuff reads like friendship stuff. But there could be something more going on there. And
well, he's so chill, too. Like, he lost his wife, and he's, like, so accepting of his daughter.
Did she tell you that she's gay? Yeah.
Like, yeah, and he's such a good friend. Right. And you just gotta be a little suspicious of somebody that seems this perfect.
Yeah.
And also the fact that he, as an actor, is married to Carrie Coon in real life, and you gotta wonder, how are they gonna get these two in a scene together?
Yep. So maybe there was a past there. Maybe there was a sexual pull, if you will, Josh.
Or like, the reason he's so zen is because he's done the work.
Yeah, who knows? It's possible. Because I think one thing we're missing too, and I think we will find this out, when Heather keeps saying, like, she didn't want me to investigate, she didn't want me to, we're missing a piece here. We're missing the final scene between Heather and Marin. We're missing maybe Heather going to Mosswood and seeing something, or either that she's not remembering or not putting the dots together on her, that she is actively covering up. We're missing something there. And because I don't know if that was the last time she saw Heather, which I don't think it was, or that she saw Marin, which I don't think it was. It doesn't really make sense that she wouldn't have investigated it. So there has to be some reason she didn't look into this more. I still think that we have to complete the loop on that. And so there may be more to this story than we're finding on both fronts, on Heather's front and on Jack's front. So the Novaks are holding something maybe for us. We just don't know. And you're right about the doctor being a good example of somebody keeping this secret, the Mosswood secret. And if Glenn Fisher is doing it too, then there's no reason why Jack Novak wouldn't have some part in this as well.
Or couldn't, at least.
Or couldn't. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And you see, I think, through the Fisher character, but also when Bill Pullman goes to Mosswood and meets with Vera in episode 4, there's graffiti that says cult, and there's like satanic symbols, and the town is not friendly to Mosswood. So if you were involved with Mosswood, especially if you had friends or you were connected in the town at all, it seems like the kind of thing you might want to cover up and you might not want to be honest about, because they're not well liked within the town. We remember from the early episodes the incident when Tracy Letts was scouting high school football and was worried about the kid who had the scholarship and all of that. So was he involved then? Was his work? I mean, I also don't know. Am I forgetting what Tracy Letts was meant to have done for a living?
I have no recollection of what it was that he used to do. So if so, then we have both lost this detail. Maybe it's somewhere buried.
He's not a retired cop, though, is he?
No, I don't think that he's a retired cop.
Yeah, I don't think so either, because I think she'd be consulting him more on the case and stuff like that. So
Yes.
Yeah. I don't know where what role that could play, but I think that there's a possibility there that he has, as a longtime resident of the town, would have had more interaction with Mosswood. And I don't think that Bill Pullman has.
Especially like after like this had happened and Marin disappeared, right. And clearly he was invested in her and knew that his daughter was upset. And if he prodded around and dug around a little bit more, he might have been like, oh, this is actually pretty cool. They make eggs and put them in your brain. I love that.
They go fishing. They're outdoors all the time. I really like this. I like gardening. They garden. I like, yeah, this is great for me. So it's possible. So we'll, I mean, I think that's a good thing to track. It's something that I think would be there. I wouldn't feel, so one of the things I liked best about The Sinner season one, and I don't want to spoil the story because I really think people should quickly knock it out if they're so inclined. But throughout the story of season one, it's similarly told as season two in that there's an unfolding mystery and you're not sure what happens. And then you get to the penultimate episode of The Sinner season one, and it is a final explanation of everything you've been wondering about the whole time. And I would say that it is mostly unexpected and also entirely satisfying in terms of how the story played out. I thought actually that was the best thing about the season for me, is that it wasn't exactly what I expected when they had been telling the story throughout, but I also felt like it totally made sense. And I think that if I'm looking at the way they told the story in The Sinner season one, if I'm expecting that sort of reveal for The Sinner season two, that it's mostly unexpected, but it's also in a way like fits perfectly, something like Tracy Letts having a larger role in this, I think could be something we could be pointing to. So I think that I think that's great. I really do. What about another ongoing mystery I'm curious about, Josh? Did young Harry Ambrose burn his house down?
Yeah. Oh, I love that we're getting more info on this, like this parallel story that is playing out. And I think that one of the reasons I love it so much is it's so instrumental to the way that part four ended, where we see Ambrose, like he's, you know, in this episode, in like the last third of the episode or so, he goes to Vera. He's going to do the work so that he can understand what the therapy session is. I think he's trying to engender some affection on her part, or at least like soften the mistrust that she has towards him.
Yeah, he says, let her be in control. That's what he says.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So he wants to go and he wants to play along. And I think he really underestimates just how broken he is, even though he does say in part three to Jack, it's like, I'm not doing well. So he's at least self-aware enough to know that that's the case. But he's really not doing well. He's an off-kilter guy. You've said that there are things in season one that really make that clear, but it's already clear just by observing him in this season that he's just a little bit off. And so when he, you know, gets lost in the woods, when his ankle gets swollen and he's hurt and he finally finds his way to Vera, he's freaking turned up. He's angry. He's mad. And it's bubbling. And he's got this rage. She's like, what are you feeling? He says, I feel rage. And she says, if you could taste what's right underneath that, what would it be? And that's when we see those flashes of the fire. And I wonder about that. Is it him as a kid that he started the fire? Is it him as a kid that he let the fire happen? And is it that there's this guilt that he's carrying with him that maybe his mom, even if she was troubled, wasn't responsible for what exactly happened? But thematically, it certainly fits with the themes of The Sinner, right? That Ambrose will have a story that is deeper than what was told on the surface, that his mom like had lost it and was unhealthy mentally and a fire occurred at the house and he needed to be separated from her. There's got to be a deeper story there, which would certainly match up with why he cares so much about these wild card cases, such as the one with Julian this season and I presume with Jessica Biel last season.
Yes, Ambrose started the fire. Yeah, you don't know.
Bill Pullman started the fire.
it's great because episode three in season two begins with him having dreams. It's child him calling for his mother, and then the child him literally sees adult him placing rocks on Bess's eyes in the motel room scene. So he's seeing himself as Julian. He's really assigning that same kind of emotion and feeling like Julian. So the connections, and we've talked about him on this podcast, the parallel story between young Bill Pullman and Julian, there's something going on there. It does make sense that if you're not going to have Jessica Biel in season two of The Sinner, she's an executive producer. She's working on the story. It doesn't seem like Cora Tinetti is going to come up other than being mentioned several times, but it doesn't seem like we're going to see the character. It makes sense that because the connective DNA between the two seasons is Harry Ambrose, that season two is in large part going to be the story of Harry Ambrose. There was definitely fertile ground laid in season one for this. And I'm just going to say that Harry Ambrose is a guy who likes punishment. He derives pleasure from punishment in some respects. He derives pleasure from being treated like he deserves to be punished. So maybe he did let the fire burn down. Maybe there was a problem with his mom, right? Like, let's just assume for a moment that his mom has psychological or mental problems, and that this is something that young Harry Ambrose doesn't know how to process and doesn't know how to deal with. And it's really screwed him up. Maybe it's given him PTSD. Maybe it's really put him in a bad place. And so he doesn't necessarily start the fire, but he lets it happen. Or even he starts the fire because he wants to try to free his mom or because of some problems that he's having with his screwed up mother. I think I see in one of those flashbacks when the fireman is sitting on the back of the fire truck and saying, like, hey, it looks like it started in the kitchen, and young Harry Ambrose says, yeah, my mom was cooking supper or whatever. And he sees his mother being taken away on a stretcher. I think I see a smile from young Harry Ambrose there. And I really think I see the edges of his mouth upturn right before we get to the crossfade of, I think it's Deakin Psychological Institute, where he is remembering what it was like to walk in and look up and see his mother on a balcony there. Which, by the way, why are patients allowed to just walk around unattended from places that they
could, especially if it's one who, like, they're really concerned about, like, harming people
or herself.
Yeah. Like, it does feel intense.
Why is she allowed to walk around on the ramparts just ready to jump off at a moment's notice? I don't know about that. But I think maybe he wanted to try to get his mom to a better place or to do something to free her from her problems. He's also talking about how she's on lithium. She was on lithium and it gave nightmares and swollen ankles. And where does he end the episode with, Josh, except nightmares and swollen ankles? So
interesting.
Yeah, there are all these weird parallels going on with Harry Ambrose, and I don't know if he's, I think that on the surface it makes sense that, as what you said, it's that because of his backstory he has a particular interest in these cases where he can sense that there is a deeper story, because he himself has a deeper story and he does need the work. So I think he can appreciate the reason why people might go and look for the work, but that doesn't mean it should cross a line. And what he's been struggling with in his whole life are these relationships or finding these things. He makes an instant bond with Carmen Bell at the Institute. He's bonded well with Julian. Julian says to him, will you be my lawyer?
That was so upsetting. Yes, that was so sad.
So sad. Let me ask you this. Do you buy...
We haven't really talked about Julian in jail, and that is just a devastating development. I feel so bad for this.
Without spoiling our Mr. Robot podcast, everyone should watch that show if they haven't seen it. But let's talk Julian in jail, and let's talk about, is there a possibility, because we're looking at Julian as a victim and as somebody who has been victimized, and we're not necessarily looking at Julian as the murderer Julian, as the guy who knew to brew the tea, as the guy who clearly killed these people. How much of Julian is an act? Is there any portion of what's going on with Julian, including the call to Ambrose begging him to be his attorney? Is that Julian playing dumb, and is there a primal fear? Is there a prison turn where we realize that he's been playing us the whole time? Is that something?
I mean,
that's very
Omen, right? Like, that's very Damien. And I mean, we have talked about, like, Shadow Julian as...
Yeah, and there's a cult involved. So is Julian the secret leader? I mean, like, we've got this Vera saying there is no leader, but is Julian at the center of it? You talk about people maybe looking to birth a new messiah. Is Julian a key figure in that cult? Is he more in control? And because let's talk about it. I didn't mean to interrupt you, but like the storage unit is in his name. His clothes are there. So what level of involvement does he have? Are we going to get a pivot, Josh? Pivot! Are we going to get a pivot from this at all?
Well, I do think that there's something very instructive potentially in the scene from last week in part three, where Julian is having the psych eval and he talks about how why he did what he did to Bess and Adam is because she lied. And if you lie, you get split in two. So he needed to bring her back to the beginning by hopefully non-painfully killing her. He miscalculated on the pain factor, that he would bring her back to the beginning and like reduce her particles back to starting over, basically, is what he says, if I'm following that right. And he says that if you lie, you're split in two. And then she starts, the person who's evaluating him says, have you lied to me across this? And he starts freaking out. Again, a little bit of Shades of Robot. And I thought that that was compelling. So if there are these two different levels of Julian that are in play, where there is like a shadow Julian that really does have a little more agency and a little more control over what's going on, that could be somebody who is more nefarious and more actively nefarious. I think that the way that I was reading it was kind of surface level of this kid who's just in torment right now, who is terrified, who is deeply scared and upset about his situation, did not really know exactly what he was doing or didn't mean to do what he was doing to such a degree, or thought that it was self-defense or that he was doing something that was coherent with his religious beliefs, something like that. And the way that he reacts to the question about are you lying, it really does strike me as somebody who is very legitimately reacting to, oh my God, I feel like internally, cosmically and karmically and soulfully, I'm being ripped in half. But could that be an act? It's not impossible. This kid is a phenomenal actor. So could that translate to Julian the character? It's not off the menu.
Yeah, Alicia Henning, he's really bringing it, and he's great. We know he's great not just at playing this kind of troubled child. He was so good on Mr. Robot, playing the exact opposite, you know, playing somebody who is wide-eyed and looking at the world honestly. I don't know. I think it's fascinating that Julian is being tried as an adult. That's something that's introduced in episode three. And we have the prosecutor who is coming off as a real jerk, right? Trying to get Harry Ambrose removed from the case. Why is he involving himself? And all of that, maybe the prosecutor's not wrong. Maybe this guy should be tried as an adult. Maybe there is more to this story of Julian, and maybe he's not the victim that we interpret him to be. You're pointing out the very scene, I think, which would cut a separate way, which is that's the exact kind of reaction that you would generate if you really wanted to kick up a fuss and really get the line of questioning stopped. That was the perfect time to do that. So you're 100% correct that it's also the perfect time to have an honest reaction. But I think because it's the perfect time to have an honest reaction, it's also the perfect time to
look at it the other way.
Right. So that's fascinating to me what's going on with Julian in that respect. The story that we are told from episode three about Vera not trusting the authorities, and she says that Adam and Bess were abducting Julian. And
I loved that because I never really had considered that from her perspective. It's like, oh, yeah, I mean, I guess that could be what happened here.
Yeah. And the thing that's going on with Julian is he's not telling Vera about his conversations with Ambrose, not entirely. I don't think that she knows that Ambrose, there's the moment in the car where Ambrose gives him the phone number and says, you got to memorize this number. You call me if you need me, right? And then he calls Ambrose. Why does he call him? Because he wants to get out. Like, I understand that he wants to get out, but he's calling him saying, can you be my lawyer? How long am I going to have to stay in here? I really think that could play either way. Genuinely, a kid in his position would hate being in there. No question about that. Especially a kid who was at one with nature. He's mentioning to Vera, there's no trees in here. I don't feel right in here. We know that about him. But this is a kid who committed a double murder. So there's definitely something deeper going on with Julian. Is he a victim or is he a predator? I don't think we completely know that yet. So
is he the predator?
Yeah, is the apex predator? Like, is he the anaconda snake?
He is the snake.
Yeah, I don't know. It's a good question, right? Like,
he's got a shoulder-mounted laser cannon that he is secretly hiding. He's got four jaws. He has invisible camouflage. He's the predator.
So I don't know.
That's the twist.
He's the predator monster. Yeah, he has the Manny Ramirez hair. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I don't want to say one way or the other. I think what I'm most interested in about this show is I don't feel strongly one way or the other. I right now feel like it could cut either way, and I think as long as they pulled it off, I would be satisfied. Totally. So
yeah, take me for the ride, the sinner. Take me wherever you want to go, the sinner. I'm here. Take me to wherever you need me to
go. Well, where they need you to go, Josh, is a cabin in the woods. How about that scene? We've joked about it. We haven't really gotten into the deep nature of what was happening in that cabin.
We haven't done the work.
It's what we've been doing it the whole time. You know, it's just that's not what you just realize you've been doing it the whole time. I think Vera was definitely playing with Pullman. There was definitely mind games going on there. She definitely drugged his tea, but that was some intense stuff. Just from a let's talk about TV standpoint, that was a really intense scene between two actors.
It was an incredible scene. And obviously you and I come to this loving Carrie Coon. You and I podcasted about just about every single episode of The Leftovers. There is that one episode podcast that seems to be missing.
It's similar to
The Sinner.
Yeah, maybe it's in a storage unit somewhere.
Yeah, Julian has our missing podcast about The Leftovers. We love Carrie Coon. She was Nora Durst, one of the best characters in anything that I've ever experienced, and just one of my very, very favorite personalities in the lore of fiction.
A large part of why we're talking about this show right now, probably the largest part, is that she's on the show.
I would agree. I think it goes, you and I needed to podcast about something because it had been way too long and Carrie Coon is in this show. Yep. That's basically what the draw was for me. So obviously she's spectacular in this scene. Bill Pullman, man. Bill Pullman, who obviously is Bill Pullman. So he's great. He's legendary, of course. But he really brings it in this scene. And like the moment where he starts to like open himself to the work and she's like, what are you feeling? He says, rage. Like there is just some excellent stuff going on with this actor to the point when I texted you and I said, I love Bill Pullman in this. And you said, he's great. I hope he's acting because it's very uncomfortable.
Yeah, I really do. I mean, what's the method, right? Like, I think that's what you responded, like method, M-E-T-H, but like yes. The capitals. But he is exceedingly uncomfortable. That scene at the Rotary Club party was one part of it, but I really loved this scene. There was physicality from the jump. He walked in all haggard and exhausted, limped in the door and was just pushing away and grabbing. And Carrie Coon is like, there you are. You finally came out. Like I wondered about that. And she knows to ask him about his mother. Like she knows something is going on there. So the thing is, we know she's been doing her homework. She brings up the Cora Tinetti case earlier and says, you know, I think you seemed like you did a really good job there. You looked into that case deeper than I think that people would have expected you to. Why did you do that? And he gives the sort of, I knew there was a story there. But I think that there is some probably level of homework that Vera has done about Bill Pullman, about Harry Ambrose. And so she knows about the mom stuff, I think. And she knows which buttons to push. And she knows that there's something deeper there. Is it a coincidence that there's a fire going when he walks into that cabin? Maybe, maybe not. Maybe that was something that was part of the triggering of him. She willfully shows him the rock, Josh, and it is some sort of rock that multiple different kinds and beliefs of people have associated spirituality with. I think we talked about maybe there was some element of that in other either Abrahamic or non-Abrahamic traditions. Sometimes people just assign value to a thing and we lose track over time over who the first person to do it was. And we just see that as a sacred thing. We're not 100% sure why. So that seems to be the case with this rock. It seemed like that, like a Native American tribe associated some value at a Pentecostal tent revival associated some value with it, and it just has some spiritual value to the people at Mosswood, and that's all we know. Speaking of the work, we certainly know it has some spiritual value to Carrie Coon. Talk about another scene, Josh. What about that scene in episode 3 where she's doing whatever it is that she's doing in front of that rock?
Yeah.
Good impression. That's exactly what it was.
That's my Carrie Coon right
yeah,
there.
Yeah, it was...
And podcast.
It was some wild, wild country meditation stuff, man. Like, it
yes,
was...
Yes,
that's what it reminded me of. There was the chaotic breathing, and there were those elements. There was the screaming and the shouting, and it was part angry and part sexual. It was just a lot, man. Like, that was a lot. And it was a hell of a performance by Carrie Coon. She later tells Ambrose, I just feel like more at ease or more... are calmer when I'm around The Rock. There's a lot more to it than that, I think. There's a whole ritual associated with what she's doing there. So I don't know what that is, and I don't know how on the level she's being with Ambrose. The ankle thing definitely fits with his proclivities from season one. He derives pleasure from pain and from allowing a woman to punish him in some respects. So I think that was really something. I don't know if she knows that level of detail about his personal life, but she's pressing the right buttons. It works. And then she definitely slips him a Mickey, and look where we end up. So yeah, I don't know. I think it could be for leverage. His gun and badge clearly have been moved. As you point out, they're not in the trunk of his car anymore. So what happened there? Are there pictures? Well, are there recordings? This is bad. This is bad news for Dean Ambrose, for Harry Ambrose.
So the one question I have is, like, so on the surface, obviously it is very bad news for Detective Ambrose to have woken up here at the exact same room where this double homicide was committed, with his gun, his badge, all of that, which he had put in the trunk, now out here. That is very, very unsettling. Is there any possibility whatsoever at all that the end of this episode is not exactly real? We've talked before about how this show has already, like, very smartly, like, kind of, like, put you in, like, dreamscape territory in certain scenes, like with the old hag, for instance, is kind of like the really big example.
Yeah, episode 3 starts with Harry Ambrose in a dream at the very spot, at the motel.
Is it possible that where we're left off at the end of this episode is, like, the start of some sort of, like, psychic journey that he's about to go on, that is, you know, him being pushed into this place by Vera? Like, is he in the middle of the work right now? Could we be looking at episode 5 as something that's, like, maybe some kind of surrealist vision at least part of the episode, if not the whole thing?
What if that's an international assassin motel?
Yes! President Pullman, present them.
Yes.
Show us your unique biometrics.
Yeah, I don't know. That would be pretty great.
Yes.
That would tie together really nicely, Josh. We already had our Mr. Robot connection. Let's do this.
Just a total hypothetical, probably one that it will not bear out. This is probably the real world, but it was just one thing that occurred to me, like, oh, do we know for sure that he is actually at the motel?
I don't know, right? And I think it's a good question. It seems to me more like the kind of thing that would be for leverage, but it does open the door for that. Speaking of opening the door, is there something in the bathroom? You think, was that a cliffhanger that we were meant to say, like, what's in the bathroom? Did he kill someone? Is Carrie Coon in there getting out of the shower? Like, what?
If so, then I think that the show didn't do a great job. Like, for me, like, if there is something really, really, really grim dark in that room, I feel like the show needed to do a better job of visually expressing that. What I was left with was just the discomfort of Harry waking up at the scene of the crime. You know, like, him being there with no idea of how he got there, and being in this place, this exact place that you do not want to be, because it is associated with the very reason why he has come home. I feel like that is the chilling feeling that you're supposed to walk away from this episode from. If there's something very specific that is, like, planted there in the motel, I don't think that the show did enough to really set that up. Do you disagree?
No, it just kind of lingered. That last shot was him looking into the bathroom. So, and he may have just been looking at the scene of the crime, if you will. Like, that's where the murder was. She was in the shower. He was in the shower. So that's possible that it's just that, and there's nothing more to it. Because you're right, they didn't really go for it. They didn't really like point that out. Like, bingo, here's something that we want you to be speculating about for a week. So I don't think it is either. But I asked you about it because there's enough of it that I wondered, like, was that a half-hearted attempt at that, or what are they going for? So I think we're on the same page about that.
Yeah, I think the show seems to be better made than that.
Yeah,
like it seems to be like a really this show. Seems to be made a lot better than I would have given it credit for just walking into season two of The Center.
Yeah.
That has been one of my big takeaways, is that this is a very cleverly written, excellently shot, very thoughtfully made series.
Season one is like that too, and it doesn't necessarily feel like that from the jump, and I did not feel like that from the way it was promoted, and that was the first reason it stood out to me. I watched it with my mom, and I said, this is just a show that, you know, your mom's gonna watch. Like, this is a mom show, and it's not a mom show. Like, it's actually a much, not to disparage anyone's mothers, but it's not, you know, my mom is she's up there in years, and it's not a show. I thought it was a show that was being targeted for a different audience than necessarily the direct prestige TV audience. And it's not that. It's not that kind of show. It is much more targeted, I think, at the prestige TV audience. It's being taken very seriously. And not to disparage my mom, she likes a lot of good TV shows, but she also likes a lot of shows that are, you know, more not the prestige TV shows. So I thought it was more in line with that, and it's not. It's one of those shows that's angling for Emmys, and good for them.
It's interesting because you and I talk about Mr. Robot, which airs on USA and is, you know, certainly in that exact wheelhouse. And I loved the show Colony, which has since been canceled. And I thought that that was a really mature, thoughtfully constructed show as well. So even though there's these shows that are on USA right now that are really of excellent quality, maybe it's just me, but I still approach a USA show with like some level of potential stink, you know, where it feels like maybe there's just going to be like some fluffy element, and perhaps that's bad on me.
Me too. Right. Yeah. And I don't want to disparage anyone's mother. It seemed like the show was being targeted to a different audience.
I don't want to disparage anyone's mother is definitely another thing that needs to become a common phrase.
I'm feeling like Harry Ambrose at this point. Like, there's a lot of mom issues coming out here.
God.
Like it just felt like a cable show that, you know, that did not feel a prestige cable show. And it's not that. Yeah. It's very much a prestige cable show. You told me when you first watched The Sinner season one that you felt the first 5 minutes felt like a B-horror movie.
Yeah, and I was like, I don't need to watch this right now. And if I had just made it like five more minutes, it sounds like I would have been in for a ride. So I'll go back to it at some point eventually. But just got to get past that that USA stigma. I think this anti-USA stance is something that I need to...
Well, I keep seeing promos for The Purge during the Sinner commercials, and I don't know what to think about that one. So, you know, they can't all be winners. They can't all be home runs. So I don't know. Maybe it's going to be great. Maybe it's going to be great. We love Mr. Robot so much, and the people over at USA are great in terms of promoting that show. They do some awesome stuff with Mr. Robot. So I think the network has a lot of good stuff going on, but you're right. The stigma, the characters welcome Blue Skies Network, and Mr. Robot, in fact, directly makes fun of that or confronts that stigma. It's real. I mean, it's a present thing. So this is a prestige TV show for sure.
Yeah. Not sure what I am able to say about The Purge other than ...
Have you seen some of The Purge?
That's all.
It sounds like you have. Okay. All right. Well,
I think that's all that I can say.
I'm actually rooting for The Purge, not on the TV show, like in real life. So we're all right.
You, my friend, are on the side of the Anaconda
Snakes.
Yes,
I am. Yeah.
All right. Anything else about these two episodes of The Sinner before we close
out? Yeah, let's do some quick hits. Purple Lake. There's 42 lakes within 25 miles of Mosswood. Are we going to go on like some kind of Wind Waker Legend of Zelda water experience? Like, are we going to go to all these lakes and dredge them up? What's the key of the lakes here?
Please yes. And Harry Ambrose is going to cross over with the Zoras.
Is this the Finger Lakes? I mean, is this the area of the state we're meant to be in here? I think that was mentioned in the first episode, maybe. I can't remember.
Depends on where in upstate New York they are. I mean, if like they're close to Syracuse and stuff, that would track.
I think we had Rachel saying that she was going to attend Syracuse and still live at home. So they seem to be close enough. This is your turf, Josh. You should know this. Did you go to Mosswood at some point?
I'm not supposed to say.
All right. I know you like eggs.
For the sake of
maybe that's the problem that Emily has with eggs. Like, here we are. This is coming full circle.
True. She's allergic to the Beacon.
Yes, I like eggs and Beacon. It's one of my favorite breakfast foods.
Indeed.
So that was the Purple Lake. We're going to have to see how that plays out. What about this deputy? We have a mysterious thin man who took the deposition and seems to be working on the side of the Anaconda Snakes. He took the deposition out of the record. So Carmen Bell's deposition against Dr. Poole is no longer there because a thin man seems to be one step ahead of the police here. Is the deputy the thin man?
Yeah, I mean, if it's going to be somebody who we know on the show,
and we have these Mosswood has played its role. It could be Tracy Letts. He's not a thin man.
I was going to say, with all due respect,
too much eggs and bacon.
Yeah, I don't think it. I don't think fits the description.
Tracy lets his pants out. I don't know. He's not. He's an older gentleman. He's got the dad bod. I think the deputy is more of a thin man. But I don't know who else would be. I suppose the attorney for the Mosswood crew is maybe that this is a guy who also has a Mr. Robot connection, Josh. He played in the pilot of Mr. Robot, Ron Rohit from Ron's Coffee.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. I think what happened was he fled to upstate New York after what happened with Elliot. And Mosswood took him in, warts and all, and we're rehabilitating him as Benji.
Yeah, like everyone's allowed in.
Yes, so. Yeah, we already know that. Like, we already know they take sex offenders directly, so here we are.
Yeah, Rohit would definitely fit in the Mosswood community. There's no question.
He'd have to leave behind his love for technology, but he could end up there. So Benji could be the guy. I think that makes some sense, right? Because he seems to be, what it seems like is that Mosswood has fixers. That we saw that in the earlier episodes where people were walking around. The guy with the ponytail was at the motel listening to what was going on with the police.
Right.
It doesn't seem like they would necessarily need the guy with the ponytail wandering around if they had a more direct police source like the thin man, if the thin man was the deputy. So I don't know. More to come on the thin man, the ballad of the thin man, for sure. I wonder as well, Marin's mom, just a real, real SOB, right? Like, this is a terrible woman. She doesn't care about her daughter. She's doing some kind of stitching, like she's doing some Buffalo Bill work up there. I don't know what's going on.
She was like accusing her daughter of like trying to steal away her boyfriend or her husband. It just seems like that was a very unhealthy, fraught relationship between those two. And she also does not seem like she is of the Tracy Letts mold in terms of accepting her daughter and her interests. When she's talking to Heather, she seems to be pretty dismissive of the relationship that existed between Heather and Marin.
Yeah, I agree. And I don't know that. I think we've probably seen the last of that lady, but she is definitely strongly juxtaposed to what's happening with Tracy Letts. I don't know ultimately where we're going to go with that, but it's not an ideal circumstance. I think what we're getting from the Marin backstory is we're really finding out the kind of person that would find Mosswood appealing, a person who's had such problems at home, a person who really feels lost and who feels like there is nothing for them in the world, a person who seems to flip from fire station to campfire to all around and seems to be interested in people from both sexes. And she doesn't seem to have a fit in this quiet small town, and certainly not at home. So I think we're getting a pretty detailed backstory on Marin for explaining why she ended up in Mosswood. I don't know if there's going to be a greater reason for that or not. There are a couple other quick hits. What about that tape that Vera plays of Bess when she's introducing? That was her reason for getting Ambrose to Mosswood. She plays this tape where Bess is doing quote unquote the work, and Bess is talking about having Julian in a pouch and maybe suffocating him. Like, what did you make of that tape, if anything more significant there?
Well, I think that in the same way that the Julian scene where he's talking about how a lie can split you in two could play in multiple ways, I think similarly here, where you could see it as Vera authentically believes that this is something that is going to be ammunition on her side. That, like, see, Adam and Bess were not great people, and they were taking my kid away, and you never really thought about that, did you? Or it could be she knows that this is, like, a relatively innocuous thing, or it's an explanation for why Bess felt like she had, like, there's unplayed aspects of it, right? Where, like, Bess feels drawn to Julian and compelled to protect Julian. She thinks something is amiss here in Mosswood, needs to get him out of there for whatever reason, right? And that aspect of it, like, that real, genuine, honest, correct need to protect this kid is being withheld in this moment. And this is really just more Vera is presenting some sort of realistic enough reason to draw Ambrose into Mosswood so that everything that is now happening would happen.
Yeah, and she, I think that's right. And she was really prepared for that, right? Like, that was not only her reason for doing it. It's interesting, though, because he's the one who says, can we do the work now? He pushes that button. She does not push the button. She's talking about the work. You really wouldn't understand it unless you did it. And he says, like, can we do it right now? And that's right after that tape is played. She says, I only record with permission, which is interesting when we talk about what maybe happened when Ambrose was out that night later on. But Bill Pullman's the one who says, can you do the work with me? Can you do it on me? Like, he's the one that asks. So even though she seems prepared, and even though she knows to say, like, did an old hag ever visit you in your dreams? You like to be in, you know, do you, what do you know about having a woman who likes to be in control? Did your mother ever leave you lost in the woods? Right. She knows the questions to ask, but it's Pullman who says, can we do the work now? So I find that very interesting as to who's working whom at the end of the day. And I don't know what's going on with that tape. Speaking of working whom and who's working whom, I started to make this point earlier. I'm not sure I put a fine enough point on it. When Julian calls Pullman and says, can you be my lawyer? It's interesting to me, like I said, his number one concern is the reason he's calling Pullman and not Vera is he wants to get out and he doesn't think Vera can get him out. So there does seem to be some level of maybe some distrust there between Julian and Vera. There are multiple scenes between the two of them throughout these two episodes where we see Julian saying, like, I'm not sure that I can trust you. Or he basically says, like, I don't know what's real and what's a dream. I don't know who to trust and not to trust. Like, he's going over these things with Vera. And he says at one point to Vera, like, you can't get me out. Like, I want to get out of here and you can't get me out. Like, that is a real problem for him. So I do wonder to what level the murderer Julian is in there. And I think the fact that he is willing to call and try to work Ambrose and maybe try to manipulate Ambrose is interesting. So I'm definitely trying to put a pin in that for later episodes. I'm trying to think, is there anything else you wanted to hit before we wrap up here?
No, just that scene at the end of 4 was so good. One of my favorite scenes that I've seen on TV in a good little while, and there's been some good TV on this year. So thank you for bringing The Sinner into my life. I am just, if nothing else, I am thrilled to have witnessed that incredible climactic moment between Pullman and Kuhn. It was just so good. The mystery of this show is very compelling right now. I think that we're in a really good spot with it. And especially having talked it through, you know, first time in a couple of weeks now, to really weigh the possibilities of, like, some of the doublespeak that could be going on here. It's nice to be in this moment with the show where you're not entirely sure where everybody is falling on which side of the line. We're in a really cool spot with season 2.
We are, and we really missed an opportunity. We should have taken a transcription of what the dialogue was in that scene, and we should have reenacted it here on this podcast.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, that's fear. I'm scared too, right? Yeah. Sexual pull.
It's the sexual Pullman.
What do you do? What are you doing? I don't know. There's no way to know. I love that scene so much. And she really wants to talk about his mom, and he's not here to talk about his mom. But I think the other thing that happens in that scene that I think, again, speaks to the possibility of Julian here is she talks about Julian being a new kind of man, doesn't detach from the inappropriate. He's at one with nature and fluid with all the darkness and all the light. So I don't think it's right to look at Julian as one thing. Like, he's a decent kid who screwed up. He is, according to his mother, or, you know, mother, quote unquote, fluid with all the darkness and all the light. So he sounds like a very powerful being here, much more powerful. We had hints of that earlier in the season when she said, my son is so much more than you could ever comprehend. So I don't know that Julian is just this a surface level that we're interpreting here. There may be more agency, and I really think that's part of it. We also saw the machine, Josh, in the scene in the cabin, just kind of present,
right,
going on
the
there.
Metronome.
What is going on with that metronome? Any ideas further here? There wasn't, I don't think, any inclination or any hint throughout these two episodes of any of the technology that may have been in play here.
No, I think it's just like something that helps lure with like the hypnotic qualities of the therapy, of the work. There's, I'm sure, going to be a deeper explanation for it, but so far I don't think that we've been given enough to really put that one together.
One of my favorite moments in that scene as well, I had the captions on when I watched it, and Carrie Coon makes a noise that the captions describe as whimpering exhale. Which I think is,
and your hashtag would be whimpering exhale if it was not already eggs, yeah, and beacon.
Yeah, eggs and beacon. Yeah. So I don't know. Lionel Jeffries, is it M A R P C C C? I don't know what any of those letters stand for. I just love it. I really love what's going on. There is mud on Ambrose's shoes at the end, by the way. So I think we're meant to think that that's real. So
I think so.
We'll
too.
See where that
the,
goes.
The top has it has dropped at this point. It's not still spinning.
Yep. Oh, good point. Yeah. The kids are out in the yard. It's fine.
Yes. Yes. Michael Caine is there, so you know that it's legit.
And yeah, I don't believe. Okay. I'm not going to get into that. All right. Anything else you want to talk about? I don't want to get no. triggered here.
Nothing else. Nothing else. Thank you guys for listening. Thank you for being patient for us having skipped out on episode 3. We'll be back next week talking episode 5 of season 2 of The Sinner. Follow Antonio. He's on Twitter at AC Mazzaro. How many Z's? How many two, R's? How many M's for that matter?
Two Z's, one R. I think there's one M right at the beginning.
I think just one M, yeah. After the AC, of
yes.
course. I am at Round Howard. Send us your feedback. Postshowrecaps.com/feedback is the way to do that. Subscribe to Post Show Recaps if you have not done so already. PostShowRecaps.com/iTunes. Your ratings and reviews are all appreciated. Tons of stuff going on here on Post Show Recaps. Sharp Objects coming to a close on Sunday night. Emily Fox and I will have our coverage of the series finale early next week. The Game of Thrones podcast, Winter Was Here, it will be resuming this week as well. Antonio, Better Call Saul, that's happening. That's real.
Yeah, it's real. It's happening. It's out. Rob Sesternino and I just dropped episode 3. Of our season 4 podcast, so you can get that on our Post Show Recaps feed for sure.
Rob and Jessica Leese have Fear the Walking Dead coverage as well. So what a time to be alive here on Post Show Recaps.
We're podcasting about The Strain. Josh, you and I are doing that.
We're doing what?
No, I'm sorry. Kidding.
Get me out of here.
It's not happening. Strigoi. Okay.
All right.
Let's walk out of here. Yeah.
All right. Lots happening. We will be back next week to talk about The Sinner. Take care, everybody. Goodbye.